Again, thank you so much for joining me. Can you go ahead and just introduce yourself real quick with your name and a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Tony Jefferson. I'm an emeritus professor now at Keele University, where I spent the last 10 years of my working life. Before that, I had 20 years at Sheffield University. I'm a professor in criminology, although I had my background is first of all in education, and I was a school teacher for a few years before I went back to do postgraduate work in cultural studies. And because of the work I was doing in that around youth subcultures and deviance, that took me, by stages into criminology. And my first job in criminology was a research project looking at policing. So I spent 10 years researching the police before I got into this work on masculinity and Mike Tyson.
Was there any particular incident or anything in particular that drew you to study Mike Tyson? It seems like
Well, first of all, the question of why masculinity, and then why Mike Tyson? I mean, in terms of studying masculinity, like so many things, there's a sort of personal dimension as well as a sort of a more professional dimension. The personal dimension was my discovering that despite, my reason and my apparent ability to control things, I wasn't able to control everything in my life, like how my children were or my relationship and so on. And so it's that disjunction between what the world tells you, you're a powerful male who should be able to do X, Y, and Z, and the reality is that in many situations you weren't so powerful. That disjunction was of interest. But in a professional sense, I was teaching a course called Women, Feminism and the Law, which I'd inherited from a woman feminist colleague who'd left, and I took over her course. And it seemed to me that if I was going to contribute anything in that area, the best I could do was to look at things to do with masculinity, because a male worker looking at, the lives of women doesn't really work, but men can look at the lives of men and probably in some ways have better equipped the women to do that. So that
So,
was how I got into it. Then the question of Mike Tyson, well, I'll be quite honest here. I thought that if I can write about somebody as well known as he was then whatever I have to say about it might get more airtime, might get more book sales because they'd be interested in Mike Tyson and not necessarily Tony Jefferson. I thought I would hitch my wagon to somebody more successful than me and see if that would, so I could make my argument through somebody very successful who would, people would be wanting to read about Tyson. So that was a kind of reason. There was another reason, finally, I'll come to, and that is that one of the things that is sort of so striking about Mike Tyson, but then he's not the only one, where he appeared to have the world at his feet. Everything was going for him after, a difficult start in life. And he blows it. He blew it. He got arraigned, tried for rape and was imprisoned. So it's that disjunction that interested me. And I had a phrase that I used called colluding in our own oppression. How is it that we, in a way, push the self-destruct button? And that was what I was interested in with him.
as men,
As
specifically.
men, yes. I mean, or anybody to be truthful, but I was interested in masculinity specifically and questions of men. But, this self-destructive side of us that is a theoretical interest, if you like.
So you have this extreme figure who's very accessible to the masses, and you're trying to use him to spotlight these issues of masculinity. And it's an incredible story that this person has, this life that this person has lived. Like you talk about the extremes, it's an incredible
Yeah.
thing to read about. Can you just to start to give us an idea of what his childhood might have been like and some of the traumas. I think the story about the pigeon is striking. Yeah. Would you mind just telling us, just to give us a picture of like a young, vulnerable Mike Tyson?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the way I read it through the various biographies, it's almost a classic deprived ghetto lifestyle. He was, he doesn't seem to have known his father, so he's brought up by a single mother. She seemed to find it difficult to cope. She was addicted, I think, to alcohol. She was, in other words, not a very able mother, not a very competent mother. And so from the usual physical economic deprivations, I think he was very emotionally deprived as well. And so he was, again, so the picture tells us, the stories tell us, he was big, rather fat, but he had this very high-pitched, lisping, feminine voice, which didn't sort of match. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, he became the butt of local bullies. So very quiet, withdrawn, passive child. And he loved, he kept some pigeons apparently, and he loved these pigeons. But one day a local bully, we don't know the real details, picked on his pigeons and pulled the head off one of them, decapitated one. And so the story goes, whether it's a real story or an apocryphal one, we don't know. He fought the boy and beat him. And from that point onwards, he joined the gang. After having been a withdrawn child, he becomes one of the gang and becomes in his turn, you know, bullying others. So that transformation from little fairy boy, as he was, his reputation or his nickname was, to becoming part of the bullying gang, I think it was called the Jolly Stompers in Brooklyn, that transformation is what happened as a consequence of the pigeon incident. And
you're talking and you're describing this environment he's growing up in, and it's the 60s and 70s and into the in New York, and he's surrounded by crime and violence and deprivation financially. It's a dangerous place, correct?
Yes, and in fact, because of poverty, I think he moved progressively to poorer and poorer parts of Brooklyn. And so, yes, he would have been in a very, as I say, the classic, deprived, crime-ridden, drug-ridden ghetto space. You're right.
And you talk, in a couple of the pieces, you talk about these sort of tropes about roles, discourses on possible roles for Black men in America during this period. And you go all the way back to sort of like Huck Finn, and then in the piece on the sexual assault trial, this stereotype of like the stud Black male, this highly sexualized Black male. Can you talk a little bit about how these largely negative stereotypes may also be something that's drawn upon by people who are surviving in environments where they have limited roles available to them?
Right, well, like, for all of us, I mean, you know, we're born into a situation not of our making. And, you know, in Tyson's case, it was, you know, a ghetto life and lifestyle, which would have offered him at that time very limited opportunities and the kind of images what we might call, or what another literature calls, role models available to him are really quite restricted. There are very few successful Black role models in the area of sports and entertainment. Yes, they're emerging, but in terms of other areas of life, they're few and far between. So basically, the kind of image or the kind of role model that the ghetto holds out held out then, and to some extent still now, is you know, the drug dealer, the successful gang leader, the person who can exhibit, you know, who's tough and looked up to because he's tough and has money, and can, and the money comes often from illegal sources in that setting. Where else can it come from? So, you know, the gangster come drug dealer, tough guy, role model is one of the few that are available. So these are, this is what, you know, young black males then and now are faced with. I mean, there have been some opening up of opportunities, particularly in the area of entertainment and sports. I mean, many sports in the US and here in the UK too are now dominated by black males and black women, where that's appropriate. You know, I can think of our athletics team, I can think of our Premier League soccer teams. You know, black males are very prominent, but you don't see so many. Well, actually, you do see a lot of black doctors in the National Health these days in the UK. So there's been an opening out of role models, but there's certainly, you know, for the poor black with very limited sort of opportunities and options, the what we would now call the subject positions available to identify with are much more limited than if you're in a different space, or if you have more opportunities. Now, okay, you were asking me about the availability of I'm calling them subject positions that he could identify with, masculine subject position. And remember, one of the big things about, you know, in the black communities, it is indeed often the absence of fathers. And if you've got also a fairly absent mother in his case, you know, this is a boy that's very confused and so withdrawn.
And so you're painting this image of this young man in this really difficult position, and he's got these limited subject positions available to him, these roles that he feels as though he can take on to gain power in society. Can you talk a little bit about that? Can you talk a little bit about this anxiety, these feelings of anxiety and powerlessness, and how there may be these defensive mechanisms that pop up? To manage this for a person like Mike Tyson?
Yeah, I mean, one of your early questions was about, you know, about the pigeon incident. Well, just think about what happens in the pigeon incident, because there is this passive boy, you know, with slightly withdrawn, who, when he's his pigeons are attacked, fights back, and if you like, reclaims some agency from the passivity of before. He transforms himself. What is going on there? Well, I think what's happening there is that, or what I try and argue is happening there, is that we deal with our anxiety, which is, you know, a natural state. I mean, we're all anxious to a greater or lesser extent. He deals with his anxiety by, in the first instance, by withdrawing from the world. It's too oppressive, too difficult. And then he changes and attacks this. What is going on there? I think he is, the anxiety, the vulnerability, the feeling of powerlessness has become insupportable. And so he flips it on its head and he projects his anxiety onto another. He projects his vulnerability onto another. and attacks it there. So one way of thinking about this particular change, the change from being bullied to being the bully, is to reach a point where the feeling of powerlessness, the feeling of vulnerability is so awful that it gets projected onto another where it can be attacked. And so, you know, the bad that was in you, or feeling of vulnerability, the bad feeling of vulnerability is projected onto another where it can be safely attacked, if you like. And this is not just, it's an explanation of a particular event, but it is also, I think, a more general process. How is it that the person who's bullied as a young person becomes in turn the bully? How is it that the person who's been sexually abused as a child becomes abuser as an adult, as we know happens regularly? I think it has this process is a more general one where, you know, you have been the abused, you have been powerless, and one way of later on beginning to regain some sense of power is to project that vulnerability onto another and attack it there. And you can then in that moment feel the powerful one. I mean, how often do women feminists tell us that, you know, rape is not about sex, it's about power and control? And in that sense, I think it's right. There is a power dimension there. You are attempting to recapture a sense of feeling powerless. So that move from bullied to bully, from abused to abuser, is, I think, about regaining a sense of power and control by expelling your own sense of powerlessness, your own sense of vulnerability. And anxiety is the sort of means, you know, if our anxiety gets too much, as it were, or a sense of vulnerability gets too much, then you know, in Tyson's case, the pigeon incident sort of sums up that transformation, I think.
And it doesn't matter if the pigeon story is necessarily an actual event. I think it's something that he's constructed as this being symbolic of that moment where he transitioned from the little fairy boy to this destroyer. Do you feel that's...
Yes, I'm sure the process was probably more gradual than that because I don't think things, you know, change in that dramatic way all of a sudden. But something like that's happened, I mean, we've all probably had similar incidents where we, you know, put up with things for so long and then suddenly we decide enough's enough, I can't put up with this any longer. Then the feeling we get having decided we weren't going to put up with that any longer, we reevaluate who we are. Oh, okay, so it is possible to fight back. You know, it is possible for things to be different. So I suspect there was a process there in his case. I was going to connect that with, it's a sort of question you asked about sort of more generally about dealing with anxiety and feelings of powerlessness and where all that comes from. I mean, what I was suggesting, or the kind of psychoanalytic dimension to this that I'm incorporating, is the idea that a Kleinian understanding of how the youngster relates first to objects, i.e. the breast, the mother's breast, and then the mother as a whole person, and how it deals with the anxiety, for example, of there being no food available, no breast available. So what does it do? It screams, it yells. At that moment, the whole world is bad, its whole world. The breast is not there. It doesn't understand the difference between breast and mother at this point. And so everything bad, and then the breast appears, and it's the food is arriving and everything's good again. So it's that the world is good or bad, and it's split. And gradually the babe will begin to differentiate itself from the mother and be able to see that, you know, the mother, the source of goodness, eventually, when it's taken away, and it will return. And if the mother does that consistently and well, then the baby will learn to not split good and bad, but to recognize that the same object or the same person eventually is both the supplier of the good and also the remover of the good. But the good and bad exist in the same person. So the transition from splitting the good and the bad to being able to recognize good and the bad in the same object is a developmental process. And what Klein said was that first version of splitting is what she called the paranoid schizoid position, where everything's good or bad and it's split. And gradually, as we begin to recognize that there is good and bad in the same object, we enter what she called the depressive position. In other words, we can tolerate the absence of the mother, the absence of the thing, because we know it's going to return. So this movement from what she called persecutory or paranoid schizoid anxiety to depressive anxiety is a process that we all go through. But if the mother is there consistently and does her job good enough, as Winnicott was to say, then the transition from a paranoid schizoid form of anxiety to a depressive anxiety can take place. Now, if the mother is terribly inconsistent, and so the babe never knows whether they're going to be fed, and the mother is not good enough in that way, this characteristic form of anxiety, paranoid schizoid, will become a feature. So splitting of the good and the bad and projecting the bad onto another will become characteristic, a way of defending oneself against feelings of powerlessness. So, as I say, if development has been good, then we will this more realistic form of anxiety, the depressive anxiety, will become more characteristic. But both forms of anxiety and dealing with anxiety are available to us throughout life. In other words, if we feel particularly threatened, we might respond in a paranoid schizoid way, that is, by splitting off the bad and projecting it on to another. But if somebody's been handled as a youngster, they may be much more likely to respond in this paranoid schizoid way. That's really what I wanted to say about that. So the defending ourselves against feelings of anxiety is something that goes on for all of us throughout life, but we can do it in a very depressive mode, i.e. sort of what I'm calling a realistic mode, or we can do it in this paranoid schizoid way. And the paranoid schizoid way does involve spitting off the bad and seeing it in another. I mean, take for example somebody who's always blaming somebody else for something. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of example of paranoid schizoid defense mechanism that, you know, it's never my fault. I can't afford to see the bad in me. I have to always blame it onto someone. I always have to spit it off and project it elsewhere. That's an example of paranoid schizoid defense in play.
And so you're talking about it. So picturing this young Tyson, and he's having these traumas, these difficulties in youth, and the anxiety that causes it results in this splitting where he's incapable of seeing good and bad in a person. They're either good or they're either bad. And then when he feels threatened by his own weakness, he then projects that on somebody else. These are like the defensive mechanisms. And am I following?
Yep. And it's important not to lose sight of the fact that we're not talking just of an internal process. We are also mustn't lose sight of the various discursive subject positions available. It's within that context. We're always, you know, our inner world is interacting with an outer world the whole time. And so the fact that Tyson's opportunities are limited in the way that they were, he seemed to have very little options, let's say, between being the bullied little withdrawn child or joining the local gang. There weren't too many other options, whereas you can imagine in someone in a very different and much more privileged position would have a range of other options available. So we mustn't lose sight of the fact that his particular choices, if you like, of joining the gang were as a way of beginning to regain a sense of feeling powerful rather than powerless. And we all want to feel at least in control rather than out of control or powerless. His were very restricted in that way. And so, you know, I don't want to lose sight of the social in emphasizing the importance of anxiety and splitting and projecting.
And that's where, so that intersection where you have the psychosocial, I believe, is that, am I correct? Would be the word that you would use. It's where the processes, the internal processes, the things that are taking place in a person's head meet the realities and the options that are available based on the society in which they're embedded, and that interplay, that process, is that the psychosocial? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, you see, remember when you enter a field, you're always entering it in relation to the existing ways of understanding. And at that point in time, I mean, there are various ways of understanding, say, masculinity, and one of them is the idea that if you say the sociological idea, the social constructionist idea, that, you know, there are a variety of sex roles out there, and we just they make us, they condition us, you know, and we, as it were, are almost passively becoming a man, which doesn't, of course, answer the question of why we become the sort of men we become. Some become heterosexual men, some become homosexual men, some become, you know, something else. But that's one version. And then there's a sort of psychoanalytic version, which is purely psychoanalytic, which might suggest that, you know, we become men. I mean, the classic version of that would be the Freudian Oedipal complex idea, that we, you know, at the moment the father enters our lives and as it were comes between us and the mother. We, the fear of the father forces us to give up the love of the mother in favor of identifying with the father, and so we become masculine rather than feminine. We adopt the masculine gender role as a result of the sort of moment of the Oedipal complex. There are other versions, but being purely sociological or being purely psychological misses out the fact that faced with a variety of subject positions, how do we choose? And that's another version. We simply, you know, we're free agents. We can choose. No, we only choose within a set of conditions that are presented to us. So how do we choose a subject position we take up? That's where the notion of investment comes in. And why do we invest in this subject position rather than that? Well, I'm using the argument based on Klein again, that we choose the positions that make us feel less vulnerable, make us feel more powerful. So we're constantly avoiding the anxiety that we would otherwise feel. So take for example the issue of homosexuality and heterosexuality for men. It's very easy being a heterosexual man because that's the thing that is the dominant subject position out there, and so we almost naturally, for many of us, become heterosexual without giving it a second thought. But for the man who's got homosexual desires, he has to, why does he go in the closet? Because the subject position of homosexuality is one that makes him very vulnerable and makes him feel very vulnerable. So to deal with that sense of vulnerability, that sense of powerlessness, because it's a heterosexual world, he goes in the closet. At some point, he may decide he feels he's got to come out of that closet and, confess to who he is. But that he has to find a way of dealing with his sense of vulnerability, his sense of powerlessness, his anxiety that he's going to promote when he comes out of the closet. So that's an example, I think, a good example of the role of anxiety determining the what we invest in. And, you know, what happens to Tyson is that investing in this new identity of the bully, they would do a little bit of thieving locally and so nothing very spectacular. I mean, his criminal record was very sparse, even though he spent a lot of time locked up in a detention center for it. Not unsurprising, given that he was a poor black male. But the fact is that it gave him a sense of power. And he says as much at various points that, you know, this was a new feeling he hadn't been used to. So his investment in this new identity, which, as I say, in the ghetto means that those who are can act tough are the ones that are looked up to, the young men who are looked up to, then this gives him a sense of feeling good, less anxious, less vulnerable. So that's the role of anxiety in relation to the subject positions available that I think in his case it's quite stark, really. It's quite a dramatic change, but not so unusual, you see, because of the limited options for feeling good in the ghetto. You know, that's the whole thing of the badass. You know, you can only feel good if you're a black male by being bad.
So this tough guy, and you talk about this not just in this environment, but in lots of environments where men are faced with limited options. I think some things I've read recently about child soldiers, where there's a very limited subject positions available to them. And this tough guy persona is one that's very commonly taken on. I mean, the most rudimentary skills that a man can have, you know, to be able to use his body again, you know, as a way to project power. But Tyson, whether it's conscious, unconscious, how much agency he had, I guess we'll never know. But he, somewhere along the way, he adopts this tough guy persona. But there are options even within that persona. You talk about there's the deprived victim tough guy, and then there's this sort of sociopathic tough guy persona that Tyson takes on. Why do you think that Tyson didn't, along the way, take on this sort of, and you see this in boxing, where it's the deprived, abused person who takes life, takes control of their life and disciplines themselves through boxing, and they're still the tough guy, but it's this victim who is made good. Whereas with Tyson, he really goes full into this sort of psychopath.
Well, I mean, I looked at that question of yours. I wasn't sure I fully understood it, but I'll give you a try to say what I think. I don't think Tyson was ever actually a sociopath. I think he was you know, did some very unfeeling things. And he certainly took a great delight, for example, after a boxing match in saying, you know, I enjoyed punching him on the nose and, you know, I wanted to push the bridge of his nose up into his brain. And he made some very, what I called in there, I think, sociopathic comments. But I think he was delighting in his new persona there in a way that I don't think, you know, there's other evidence that he was ever sociopathic. As for the deprived victim notion of a tough guy persona, I guess. What I'm understanding by that at the moment is somebody like Floyd Patterson, for example, who was also went from poor background to heavyweight champion of the world, also with the same manager, incidentally. He in a way, was more in touch with his deprived background and was not attempting to escape it in quite the dramatic way that perhaps Tyson did. What I think I'm suggesting about Tyson in that regard is that he identified very strongly with the most macho, the most power conferring of the subject positions available. So instead of being a sort of a poor guy made good, but remaining Mr. Nice Guy, he identified with the kind of the excessive dimension of becoming very rich and well known, and that being excessive, which in his case involved, you know, sexuality being a big part of that, and in a way enjoying all the fruits of his success, has to do, I think, with the extent of the feelings of the old feelings of powerlessness, the little fairy boy feelings. So that's the only way I can and think about that the more strongly he identified with all these subject positions, these very macho subject positions, which is again something that kind of drew me into the topic, because he really was extreme on all of these dimensions, both in relation to his time in the ring, the way he delighted apparently in dominating his opponents absolutely, and the way in which he apparently was, you know, wanting all the fruits of success and grabbing it because he was able to when it wasn't available otherwise, then I think we are talking about somebody who, you know, was distancing himself extraordinarily from his past, his and the feeling that he was felt. I mean, there were one or two little things that come out of the biographies, like when he first arrived in the detention center, and the man who then went on to train him with boxing said he was frightened of his own shadow. This is a boy, a child who's part of a gang who's supposed to be a tough guy, but actually he never was, and so distancing himself from that sense of powerlessness, that sense of vulnerability. How sexual assault victims sometimes repress the memory, so they can't remember in their adulthood that they were abused as a child because it's too painful. Well, one of the other, you know, the classic defense mechanisms to repression, I mean, which is why psychoanalysis is seen as digging up some of that stuff and talking about it and trying to put it in another place. But repression is a very characteristic defense mechanism. It's so painful that you push it deep down and it becomes unconscious. And in the same, a similar sort of way, the sort of childhood he seemed to have had before the time of changing into the bully and then into the boxer was really very painful, I think. You know, a mother who really, you know, if you're an alcoholic mother with not enough money to bring up your children, I don't know that you can really be there for them emotionally. And, you know, so not only is this, as I say, he's physically deprived, and he'd got various, you know, what felt to me like difficulties that he could do very little about, like the nature of his voice, the fact that he lisped, the fact that he had this high-pitched voice and yet a huge frame. So he was unusual, and unusual in a lot of situations, but especially in poor places where, you know, there's not much else going on, perhaps, that you know, you can get your kicks by teasing, bullying somebody who's different. I mean, we know that's a fact. The question of difference is always a problem. He was different, and as I say, he was had so little emotional support, as far as I can gather, that, you know, hiding away and protecting his vulnerable self the best he could was you know, all that was there for him. But when another route opened up, he seemed to embrace it with real enthusiasm, and you know, he could be not little fairy boy, but he could be the complete destroyer. And you know, one of the interesting things in all these biographies is about determination. I mean, learning to box is one thing, but the way in which he gave himself over to it is something else. I think the same was said about Muhammad Ali, that, you know, when he first started boxing, he wasn't so different from everybody else. But what differentiated him, and I think what differentiated Tyson, was the commitment to the discipline, the commitment to it. And that tells me that it's doing something psychologically, doing something for his emotional life to do that. Because for most of us, you know, we give it a try and then we say, oh, well, this is too much like hard work, I'm going to give this up, because we've got other options. But when your options have really narrowed down, this was his, you know, this moment to change, to be something different and to have people respond to him differently. And he grabbed it.
You talk about, you just mentioned Muhammad Ali, and I think it's interesting. So these subject positions that are available to young men in our society, if you compare Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson, they're both people who didn't have a lot of options. They had these, there were a lot of restrictions placed upon them, and they were able to find their find power by adopting these extreme personas, becoming heavyweight champion of the world, the baddest man on the planet. Yet they're very different. What, now they're not just, they're not living their lives, and they're not only living out their lives, but they're creating new subject positions for younger people to adopt. And I'm just wondering, what type of a role do you think that someone like a Mike Tyson has had when and changed? Do you think it makes a change in society where you move from a Muhammad Ali? Can you talk a little bit about the difference in the persona, yeah, and what the implications of those differences might have on the rest of society?
Well, I think, you know, several differences emerge. First of all, that Muhammad Ali had a much better, more privileged sort of background than, it wasn't the sort of, you know, I think he had a father and a mother and a reasonable kind of, I don't know exactly, but not a deprived background in the way of a Tyson. So his route into boxing might have been slightly different. However, one of the big differences is the position of black people in the 60s and in the 80s, which is when Tyson comes to his, you know, adulthood. The 60s, of course, was a momentous period in the US for black people. The civil rights movement of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and then, of course, black power at the end of it. And so you got a huge transformation from black is, you know, get back, to black is beautiful, and a huge revaluation. So by the end of the 60s, you know, to be young and black, certainly you were still getting picked up by the cops. Yes, you were still being, you know, badly treated, discriminated against, but the image of the black male had taken a huge change, and there was a sense of power in just in being a black male, wearing your afro and you know, your black power badge maybe. And in that context, of course, we do know that Muhammad Ali gave up his old persona of Cassius Clay and became a Muslim, the black Muslims, and became very political and didn't go to the war in Vietnam. And so was a huge role model in that regard. So he becomes very political and sees his you know, ability to box, he uses that perhaps unselfconsciously and to some extent consciously as a huge role model. And you know, who is the most, you know, regarded boxer ever? I mean, it has to be Ali, I guess. You know, now Tyson, he comes to his adulthood in a period in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, when the Black Power movement has been frankly decimated by shot. Many of them shot by the police, or like Eldridge Cleaver, they fled the country. And, you know, the civil rights movement has stalled. I mean, yes, certain things have changed, but, you know, as we know with Black Lives Matter today, you know, that being poor and black and on the streets means you're liable to be shot by a cop. You know, those things haven't changed dramatically. And of course, question of poverty and the question of discrimination, they're still very much part of lifestyle. So, I mean, that drugs have destroyed communities and poor communities everywhere. So the situation that he was faced with, you know, there was some optimism in the 60s. I think in the 80s, it's shifted. It's not the same. And so and of course, we've had a very individualistic, you know, I mean, the emergence of neoliberalism has emphasized individualism over the slightly more collective notion of that was around the 60s. And so, you know, being black began to mean, you know, if you were a celebrity black or a successful black, how many pairs of trainers you could buy, or how many, you know, it was about consumption, it was about celebrity, it was less about, the politics had disappeared to some extent, and that's been tragic. And I think that means that Tyson was never as politically engaged in that way as Muhammad Ali, because the moment had changed, and therefore what he could offer was a different kind of role model. And in fact, it was a kind of a role model of excess and of lifestyle. And but I don't blame him for that. The situation had changed. One of the interesting things you ask, I think one of the questions about him now, I mean, after he'd come out of prison and done all kinds of things, I haven't been following it in detail, but I think he did come out of a prison with a Chairman Mao tattoo or something. So, yeah. You know, like many black people,
and also became a Muslim as well.
Yeah. So, you know, there was a sense of you know, the prisons politicized, you know, they always had. Malcolm X was the same. He goes in a prison as a hustler and he comes out, you know, politically engaged. And George Jackson you could name a solid Ebb brother, you know, you could name any number.
Do you think so? So you talk, we talk about Tyson changing. Do you think that change was that necessarily just the being politicized because of the prison experience? Do you think that age, his growing older, may have played a role as well in determining what? So his the position of, you know, being the complete destroyer is not necessarily as available to him now as he grows older. So adopting the political, is this something that might take place, or would he? Is there a chance for change over time as he grows older?
Oh yes, no, absolutely. Remember, because by the time he's in prison, all right, he's there for a rape, but you know, he's already globally known, and he's also, you know, although he probably lost a lot of money as well as made a lot of money, he's also unlikely to ever have to, you know, go to the soup kitchen. I mean, his name will get him through, and so he's in a very different position in terms of his relationship to power. He's now one of the powerful, almost by definition, and that will change the way he views the world. I mean, and so his position has changed, and his ability to process things differently therefore changes, because, you know, the sense of powerlessness isn't there for him in quite the same way. He is a powerful man, the adopt. And so undoubtedly he's going to change and be different because of that. So how exactly, I don't, you know, as I say, he's no longer quite the public figure he was, and so I haven't been following it really, but you just catch little bits here and there, and it feels like so many of us, he's learned some lessons from his past. Why wouldn't he? And thinks about things differently. And it's, you know, he's got children, and these make you think, see the world different. There's so many things change about one situation that, you know, the ways of the characteristic ways he may have adopted in the past of coping with anxiety will have shifted. And, you know, the paranoid schizoid defense mechanism, I would say, necessary for him.
So we can say something, there's something positive. So as we move through life, the subject positions available to us may change, and our perspectives may change, and then we may change as well.
Yeah, I mean, but it can work both ways, of course. I mean, we might start off life, you know, very optimistic and in a good position, and various things happen to us, yes, that put us in a bad position, and so, okay, we become more paranoid the older we get.
I was trying to be positive here. We started with pigeons having their heads ripped off. We need some positivity.
Yeah. I'm trying to be realistic.
Yes. I'd like to just talk, I know your time's valuable. I just have a couple more things I want to talk about. And the main thing was taking, so Mike Tyson is this extreme version of life, you know, everything's extreme, and he's this famous person. If we were to apply this type of thinking to more mundane professions and ways of living, and I'm thinking, I study policing, I'm thinking about police officers.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about these feelings of anxiety and fear, and how those may be managed by police officers. Can you talk a little bit, I know you've studied policing, can you talk a little bit about how this deviant behavior may result from this same type of phenomena a little bit in policing? Well, is that possible?
At the personal level, you know, there'll be police officers that deal with their anxiety in a very reasonable, you know, what I'm called depressive way, and there'll be some that are more susceptible to the paranoid schizoid way of thinking. However, as a group, if you think of them as a group, what is happening on the streets is that one group of young men who are very anti-police and anti-authority and so on, and therefore act up all the time. These are Tyson and his gang, if you like, meet another group of young men whose job it is to keep these men in order. And what you've got there is two masculinities meeting up. And not only is it a question of, you know, if I'm a police officer and a young black male comes up to me and says, fuck off. Well, I, you know, at a personal level, that's pretty, you know, distressing, and I might react badly at a personal level. But you've also got the level of the state. Your job is to respond to that and to reassert authority and to tell them that we're the state. And so there's a sort of double thing going on there. And third element is that if you're in a group of police officers, you can bet your bottom dollar that the one who's the most paranoid is going to be the one that's going to get you into trouble, the paranoid schizoid type. He's going to be the one that reacts first to that insult. And of course, you're going to support him because he's your side. Loyalty, brothers, we're brothers. And often that's what happens, you know. You get an incident which is precipitated perhaps by the group males, you know, being disrespectful to the police officer. You should be able to absorb that. But if there's one of your number who can't because he's personally insulted and really reacts badly in those situations, you're going to support him. And so quite often what you get is sort of these two masculinities, you know, locked together. But unfortunately, as I say, it's the most paranoid elements on both sides that create the problem. And you have got to support your gang, and your police have got to support your gang. You know, the riots that we have in the UK and you have in the US are triggered by a policing incident which, you know, told from the police side would seem fairly reasonable, but told from the other side does not seem so. You've got these competing versions, and often what's at stake is you're not going to step down as a male. You're not going to step down if you're a male gang member. You're not going to step down if you're representing the authority of the state. And in any case, you know, the reason you've signed up is you joined a strong band. So it's very interesting, this question of masculinity and police officers. I mean, I do remember I was in Australia as a sort of sabbatical month lad in the New South Wales Police Academy to advise these police about research. I mean, the dean there was an ex-academic who had got all the police officers to do bits of research. So I was there helping them with their research. And at the end, I addressed the passing out parade of the young new cadets who just qualified. And I talked about masculinity, like I'm talking to you about masculinity and policing. And I don't know what they made of it. They listened. But, you know, it is often about competing masculinities. And you've got to be the adult in the room that says, I'm going to let him swear at me because, you know, he's getting it off his chest. But if you can't deal with that and you've got to strike back to say, I'm the dominant male, not you. So it is about dominant, you know, males going head to head, and which is why I think that more women police officers on the street dealing with those situations would be a good thing.
It's a good thing. And yeah. I remember as a young police officer having people question me, having people push me, and feeling threatened by it, that my authority was being undermined, and it's anxiety provoking, and responding in ways that I may not necessarily have been the best way to respond. Yeah. And so I think it's important for police officers to first step, I think, is being aware that everyone feels this way, that when we're as human beings, no matter what you're doing, there's power involved, and there's a struggle involved, and we feel fear and we respond to it. And if we're aware of it and we're conscious of it, then maybe we can manage it a little bit better.
Yeah. All that sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But unfortunately, words, you know, they do.
They definitely do. I wanted to thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. One final thing. We're in the middle of a global health crisis right now. It's the 7th of April, 2020. Where are you right now? What part of the world?
I'm in Sheffield, which is the north of England. I'm at home, like everybody.
And you're staying safe. How's your community?
Yeah, doing? Well, funnily enough, I had already decided to virtually self-isolate because I'm writing a book and I have to deliver it hopefully by July 1st. And so one of the things I've been doing in retirement, I like doing, is traveling. And I have, you know, I was traveling a lot here, there and everywhere, but I decided, you know, the further I got into this book, I really, really had to stop traveling and settle down. So I had given up traveling for the time being and I was settled in, and apart from going to the gym and going to the pub to watch some football or, you know, going to the local cinema to see the odd movie, I was really very home-based anyway. And then suddenly everybody else caught up with me. And
okay. Well, I'm glad that you're doing well. Please be safe. And again, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.